Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Washington Examiner, a conservative newspaper, is reporting that a fifth woman says she was subjected to inappropriate behavior by Herman Cain. That woman, Donna Donella, says that after a speech Cain gave about a decade ago, he asked her to set him up with an audience member. When Donella declined, Cain suggested the two of them go on a date instead. Cain hasn't responded to this latest allegation, but last night on Jimmy Kimmel Live, Cain described what it was like to hear yesterday's claims of harassment by accuser Sharon Bialik.
The feelings that you have when you know that all of this is totally fabricated, you go from anger, then you get disgusted, and then when it was all over with, I said, well, I know what we got to do, because there's not an ounce of truth in all of these accusations.
Cain says he'll hold a press conference today to, in his words, set the record straight. Meanwhile, Sharon Bialik appeared on ABC's Good Morning America today to back up her claims. She reiterated that she is a registered Republican and she was not paid to go public.
It's not too late that he can step forward and just end this, just end it. End it by saying, I did these things, I did some inappropriate things, it was a long time ago, I apologize, but just move forward. Let's get past this. Let's get to the real issues.
Bialik also says that she is not after a settlement, which at least two of Cain's victims have received, and that she just wants to, quote, give him a platform to come clean, to tell the truth. We want to take a look at sexual harassment in the workplace. Deborah Katz is a lawyer at the Washington, D.C. law firm Katz, Marshall & Banks. She specializes in employment discrimination and civil rights cases. Deborah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Deborah, for starters, I wonder if this woman had come to you and had said that someone reached his hand up her skirt, pushed her head on his lap, as the accusations have been against Cain. Hearing that, does that to you constitute sexual harassment? Is it enough information for you to work with?
Well, sexual harassment is any kind of unwelcome sexual advance or unwelcome request for sex. Now, what makes this situation slightly different than one in which someone is actually employed is she was out of a job and she was actually looking for his assistance in getting a job. But the law also covers job applicants. To the extent that he was conditioning, you know, submit to oral sex or submit to this unwelcome touching and I'll help you get a job, which is essentially what she's alleged, that would be sexual harassment.
There is a lot of case law for sexual harassment, and part of the law says that occasional or sporadic teasing or gender-based jokes, even offhand comments, don't necessarily amount to sexual harassment that you can bring a legal case about. On the other hand, if it's hostile or abusive, it can be so-called actionable, legally actionable. That's very subjective. How are you distinguishing between the two?
Well, that's a very good question, and the Supreme Court has grappled with this quite a bit. But the court has said, look, this is not a mathematically precise test. We look at a host of factors, and we look at the totality of the circumstances. So for harassment to be actionable, it has to be either severe or pervasive. If there's touching, if there's a barrage of unwelcome kind of comments in the workplace, those are the kind of behaviors that create an environment that is intimidating and is infused with ridicule and abuse, and that would be classically a sexually hostile work environment. The occasional off-color jokes, that would not be actionable.
In what cases do sexual harassment claims end up on the desk of a lawyer like you versus resolved internally at a company?
Well, it really depends on what the track record of the company is. Many people work in environments that they know that going to the HR department is tantamount to subjecting themselves to further retaliation, and people are very scared to do that. HR departments are not known in many respects for being supportive of the person who's coming forward, so people get very scared to do that. On the other hand, the Supreme Court in 1998 put the burden on victims of harassment to avail themselves of the policies that employers do have. So employers may have shiny policies with bells and whistles, that say, if you're harassed, you must go here, you must report it in this manner. And if the alleged victim of harassment does not do so, she may find herself without a legal claim later on. So it's important to understand what policies the employer actually has and whether those policies actually work, whether they actually get to the bottom of harassment and whether they take appropriate corrective measures when harassment is actually found.
And Deborah Katz, the stakes for employers can be high. There are cases in which employers can be held liable for the sexual harassment by their employees. When are employers held liable?
Employers are liable in situations where high-level officials conduct the harassment. Employers are always liable when their owners and officers who conduct the harassment, or when there is what is called a quid pro quo variety of harassment, which is do this in exchange for a job, do this in exchange for a promotion, or if you don't have sex with me, you're going to lose your job. Employers in that situation are always liable. It gets more complicated in a sexually hostile work environment situation. In that situation, the employer can actually get out of legal liability if they can show two things. One, that they took appropriate corrective and preventive measures to prevent harassment and, when it's reported to them, to fix the problem. And two, if the complainant failed to avail herself of those policies. If the employer can show both of those things, there's lots and lots of case law that says that the employer will not be responsible for the sexually hostile work environment.
Although there are also cases when a court finds that it was reasonable that an employee decided not to go through the internal process. Isn't that right? That there was a reason that they might have felt that I don't want to go to HR, that might make things worse?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've dealt with many, many cases where the harasser actually threatened the woman and said, if you go to HR, you're destroyed. You're out of here. And many complainants have reasonable fear and a reasonable basis to have fear that if they go to HR, they'll lose their job. So the courts really look at the entire situation and whether that complainant's fear was reasonably based.
When it comes to proving cases of sexual harassment, you've said that often you're either looking for other women who've left the company to see if they've had similar experiences, or you look for evidence, things like GIFs or text messages.
Oh, yes.
In this 21st century world, in some ways, is sexual harassment becoming easier to prove because of things like texting?
Yes. It's amazing the things that people put in writing and don't think it's going to come back as evidence of unwelcome sexual advances later on. Text messages, emails, GIFs, lingerie, requests to go on business trips, and lo and behold, they arrive in their adjoining rooms. That's the kind of evidence that you look to. Sexual harassment is ultimately an abuse of power. And in situations where we see sexual harassment, there's usually some element of recidivism where the alleged harasser has done this with other women. And a very good way to look for evidence is to contact people who have left the workplace. And very often when we make that call, we're greeted with, boy, I've been waiting for this call for lots of years. I knew it was going to happen.
In the case of the women who've accused Herman Cain of sexual harassment, we know that at least two of them have received settlements. In one case, $35,000, I believe, in the other, $40,000. On the other hand, when we remember Paula Jones, who sued President Bill Clinton for sexual harassment in the 90s, her settlement was $850,000. Why do we see such wide disparity in the amount that some of these settlements are?
The law under which Paula Jones sued President Clinton is different than your typical Title VII case. And the Title VII law, despite how people go on and on that this is a lottery ticket and people file these charges to make tons of money, actually Title VII has very low caps on damages. For a large employer, the most money that someone can win is $300,000 of compensatory and punitive damages. That's the cap, plus back pay. That is not a lot of money, and certainly not in today's terms. The law was passed in 1991, setting those limits. If you work for a small employer, you could be limited to damages of only $50,000. So it really depends on what jurisdiction you work in. Where I practice in Washington, D.C., there are uncapped damages, and you can sue individuals. So the kind of settlements that you would see in cases here are typically much higher than they would be just across the river in Virginia. That doesn't have that kind of state law. But another real driver as to the value of the settlement is the salary of the person making the allegations, to whom they are making the allegations against, and whether they have been fired or whether they're being put in a position where they're going to have to give up their job. And there are just a whole host of factors that go into coming to the right number.
Deborah, just to clarify for our listeners, you mentioned Title VII. That's part of the Civil Rights Act, and that's what makes sexual harassment illegal. Deborah, in the case of the two women who accused Kane and who each received a settlement, the National Restaurant Association, where he worked at the time, says those settlements are not an admission of guilt. Is that often what we see here? Money being paid, but with the caveat that we're not to assume that that means the supposed perpetrator was guilty?
I would say that in 100% of settlement agreements that I have been involved in over the almost 30 years I've done this work, every single settlement agreement would have what's called a non-admission of liability. It doesn't matter what they're paying and whether they're caught red-handed, employers will always require a provision in the settlement agreement that says we're paying this to avoid the inconvenience of litigation, but this is not an admission of liability. Well, in a case where you're paying $35,000 or $40,000, which was tantamount to 1 year of salary, in my view, that's an admission of liability.
Does an employer at least have an obligation to do further investigation of that accused employee to make sure he or she doesn't sexually harass someone again?
Absolutely. The Supreme Court has made absolutely clear that employers have an obligation to provide employees with workplaces free of sexual harassment. And when employers are told or put on notice that someone has engaged in sexual harassment, they have a duty to investigate the claims and to take prompt and effective corrective measures. If that means firing somebody because they engage in sexual harassment, that's certainly within the employer's prerogative. Unfortunately, in many of these instances, because of the inherent power differential, you have someone who's the more high-level person, the more moneyed person, perhaps the rainmaker, who's engaged in the harassment against a low-level person, and employers find it more expedient to pay a settlement and have the woman depart from the workplace.
Do you find that as a result, sometimes you end up with serial harassers?
We absolutely see many cases with serial harassers. It's an incredibly flawed system, and it's very sad. And you can see from what's already happened with Ms. Bialik today that immediately someone comes forward and their motivations get impugned, and it becomes open season to try to discredit that person. And it takes a very brave act to come forward knowing that you are going to be in the crosshairs. That's often what happens is people get attacked and their motivations get impugned rather than actually investigating what occurred.
Deborah Katz is an employment lawyer at the Washington, D.C. law firm Katz, Marshall & Banks. Deborah, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Herman Cain, as part of his response to the sexual harassment allegations against him, has said that people don't always understand his sense of humor. That made us wonder, when does a joke go over the line in the workplace? And how do companies respond to questions of sexual harassment? Up next, we'll hear from a woman who works with companies in the throes of sexual harassment cases. And later in the show, the lights are still out in some parts of the Northeast after last month's freak snowstorm, and that may throw a wrench in some local elections in Connecticut. We'll hear how one family's been coping. Back in a minute, here and now.